I am so pleased to get you to hear one of the most creative human beings. Some of you know her. I have ever met. As a matter of fact, I told her earlier today at the beginning of the first service that one of you at the Ordinary Life Happy Hour, and she guessed who, referred to Stephanie as a saint. The Reverend Stephanie Warfield serves as an educator at Seton Spirituality Center, and before serving in that capacity, she served as a chaplain with the Seton Cancer Care Team. And her previous work involved spiritual care counseling to adults at Chivers Center, the outpatient clinic there. You were at Ronald McDonald House here. And Sherry and I went to California so that I could participate in her ordination service. And she is among the first board-certified interfaith chaplains. And she's very passionate about creative ministry, using art and poetry and worship and journal writing. She's published 3 books, Lenten Reflection Journal, Creative Pastoral Ministry Handbook, a journal of interviews with a teenage cancer patient in the weeks before her death. And if you've ever gotten an email from her, you know that her mantra, her signature on her email is, "Listen softly and carry a big heart." Here's Stephanie Warfield.
Thank you. Oh my. That's a lot to live up to. And I will be perfectly honest, I'm very nervous because it's been such a long time since I've been here. So I have way too much information, so I might be editing on the fly here. But that's the gift of my contemplative practice. When I sit with an intention, so much comes in that I have trouble weeding it out. And after I'd written this whole thing up, on Friday afternoon, I got an email from something called Everyday Wisdom. It's a Buddhist email that you get. And it had this little poem that I just really, really love called Wearing a Hat of Stars. So I thought I'd start with that. Wearing a hat of stars, riding the moon, crossing the sky, blowing the trumpet of sadness and happiness, I always remember you. And then this came also from Audre Lorde. Only by learning to live in harmony with your contradictions can you keep it all afloat. So I am really, really happy to be here. So this whole moral obligation to be happy, I'm very happy to be here. I missed this class tremendously. I really have not in the 8 years, I think it's been 8 years that I've been in Austin now. I haven't found my home church there, so I'm happy to be here. I am nervous. Like I said, the ego self has kicked in so many times. It's like, you better make it good. So my ego is not always happy. But I wanted to share another poem because we use a lot of poetry where I am now. And this came several months back. I've been doing a whole series of luncheons in our healthcare system because there were a lot of layoffs recently and people were living with fear. So I came across this poem called Faith by David White, and I wanted to share it with you. I want to write about faith. About the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night. Faithful even as it fades from fullness, slowly becoming that last curving and impossible sliver of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I refuse it even the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. So, maybe even a small amount of happiness, a sliver of happiness, can be that first prayer opening us up to something grander. Dorothy Day also wrote, "The greatest challenge of the day is this, how to bring about a revolution of the heart, a revolution which has to start with each one of us. A revolution of the heart which has to start with each one of us. So, what do these words have to do with that moral obligation to be happy? First slide. Okay, and then... Yeah? Yeah. All right, so which path have you been on? The first one? Anybody raise your hand if you've been on that first, really clear path. I'm so grateful that I'm in good company here. Yeah. I've never been on that straight path. Here's another prayer. This is one of my favorite ones that I use all the time by Betty Claire Moffitt. And it goes like this. Open our hearts that we may see visions of good you have for you and me. Open our hearts that we may hear your love and wisdom guiding us clearly. Open our hearts that we may feel all that is true, all that is real. Open our hearts that we may know what we must do and where we must go. Open our hearts that we may be whatever in love you want us to be. Amen. So up until now, I've been focused on a few things. Faith, no matter how small, revolution of the heart as a great challenge, and opening our hearts to seeing, hearing, feeling, and knowing whatever might befall us. Well, at least for me, that's not so easily done. Maybe you guys have an easier way with it. Again, what does this have to do with that moral obligation to be happy and the title that I gave this, Happy Talk? Are you also aware that there's some happiness apps? Did you know that? There are actually some happiness apps. One of them I can't get because my iPad is so old, I can't install the new happiness app. So I guess I'll have to wait. But it's called Hapco. And what happens with this is it checks in with you at different times during the day, and you get to rate how happy you are on a scale of 0 to 5. I know, somebody critiqued me for even sharing that with a group one day, and I thought, well, yeah, there are other ways of checking in with yourself and seeing if you're happy, but I kind of think it's a good reminder because it sends you that little message, how happy are you? And you go, how happy am I right now? This morning when you woke up, did you check in with yourself and say, how am I feeling? Am I happy? Am I sad? Am I somewhere in between? So pay attention to what happens during this talk. Check in with yourself. See if you're happy, sad, or somewhere in between. Recently, a friend sent me an email with this title, How to Find Happiness. Step one. Think of where you last saw it. And number two, see if it's still there. Isn't that what we're always doing, pursuing happiness? So here's my little update for you. As Bill said, I'm no longer working as a chaplain, but I am still in ministry, just in a different way. When my work ended suddenly at Ronald McDonald House almost 8 years ago, I gratefully, oh so gratefully, received and accepted a position as chaplain for the Seton Cancer Care Team in Austin. Much of my work there involved patients, families, and staff at Shivers Cancer Center. Shivers is an outpatient clinic, part of the Seton Healthcare family that provides treatment and resources, hope and love, wisdom and compassion for a wide variety of persons, many of them uninsured, underinsured, self-employed, homeless, immigrant, refugee, and yes, even the normal working citizens of Central Texas. And Shivers is a magical place. Not that everyone who gets treatment there receives the miracle of physical healing. What does happen there, however, is this. Shivers becomes a home, a place of family between patients, doctors, nurses, and the care team, a sacred gathering place to honor the pain and the joy of cancer And yes, there is joy in cancer. I absolutely loved working there. In 2010, I created the Prayer Flag Project, which allowed patients and their family members to create prayer flags while a patient received chemo in our infusion room. One patient, after much thought, created a flag called the Circle of One, which gave the project its true mission. The infusion room truly is a circle of oneness. There are many faith traditions and no faith traditions represented by the people who sit in that space. There are many races and cultures, a small United Nations of sorts in the people that receive treatment there. A wide range of languages are spoken, including English, Tex-Mex, Spanish, Chinese, Vietnamese, Polish, Farsi, Arabic, and others. People receiving treatment in this room come from a variety of life paths, schooled and unschooled, homeowners, homeless. Some have limited financial resources. Some have children to care for, and others have adult children caring for them. Others are alone. And yet in this space, in the infusion room, where the chairs are arranged so that people can see into the faces of one another, a circle of oneness is born. In this place, there is a sense of equality. Everyone, a human being in need of cancer caring and an infusion of healing. And each of the prayer flags, everyone who created one, it represented a very personal story. All of them just happened to be connected to a disease called cancer. And all of them representing something much bigger than cancer. These flags were our sacred offerings of truth and hope and love in all its many colors. They showed us courage, faith, determination, hope, love, and laughter. And each of them beg us to celebrate life, and they honor and bless us with their creation. And yes, these people who created these flags did find moments of happiness in that space. As intended, the more than 200 prayer flags in five languages, English, Spanish, Arabic, Vietnamese, and Bengali, infuse those who see them with healing, love, and peace. So not only was it an infusion room for chemo, it was infused with all these words or artwork that created peace. And when a patient lost their battle with cancer, each family member then was given a paper copy of the flag as a keepsake. Come see the flag. This is what the room looks like. There's actually two circles that go around, and people sit in the outside chairs, and so you can look up and see the flags. About 2 weeks ago, I learned that a really much-loved Shivers patient had died. He created the most talked about and the favorite prayer flag. I don't have a copy to show you up there, but quite simply, his flag reads, "Ouch, stop that." Very clean and simple. Everybody could read it. And it really is the most loved flag up there. And all of the nurses will tell you that they were not the one that inspired those words. Ouch, stop that. Couldn't that be said for so many things in life? As a chaplain, part of my ministry is to walk with someone and heal some of that ouch. Perhaps that's also sharing a moment of happiness. I read recently that Mark Twain wrote, "The two most important days of your life are the day you are born and the day you find out why." Yeah, that's kind of stopped me in my tracks. So everybody in here has been born. And have you discovered why yet? Yeah. And if you have, do you remember when it happened? How'd that feel? Well, finding St. Paul's was part of my discovery process toward that question of why. And it hasn't always felt happy. I'm sorry, Bill, but that moral obligation to be happy has always been a tricky one for me. Anybody else feel like that too? My little path has been so well-worn with detours and bumps on the road. Remember that earlier diagram? That was me, up and down, into the river, up another hill. I think I'm still climbing. I found St. Paul so many years ago when my only sister was living and dying with cancer. It was her home church, and she loved this place. Through the gift of people like Gail Williford and Terry Thompson, I also came to know and love St. Paul's by watching how people cared for my sister and her family, and by extension, me. But I was living in Connecticut at the time, happily married and exploring a graphic design career. It would be a few more years until I returned to St. Paul's, and once again, it was because of a difficult life event. This time, I rediscovered St. Paul's because of a need for help in raising a troubled teenager, my stepdaughter. And at that time, I found some Mind and Spirit class. I clearly remember my first visit to that class. I sat in the very back. Be careful back there. I was sitting next to Bob Pate, and Bill was sharing wonderful stories about a trip to the Grand Canyon. People were laughing. This was Sunday school? Wow, maybe it could be fun. I guess in Bill's class, there is a moral obligation to be happy because of his unceasing joke telling and, yes, magic. Well, I'm not very good at either of those things, so I did bring a short joke. I had to write it down because I'm never good at remembering them. If the cops arrest a mime, do they tell him he has a right to remain silent? That's the last joke. All right. Bill has another form of magic, however, much more wonderful than the tricks he shows us here. It is in the magic he possesses for allowing others to heal. And I am one of those magic tricks, with deep and unceasing gratitude. And I wouldn't discover the gift of Bill's magic until another difficult event, the end of what I had believed was a very happy marriage. Believe me, I felt very little obligation to be happy in those days. And what many in this room who know me do not completely know is how totally devastated I was. It was such an awful time, even though I still was enjoying the love and support of many people here at St. Paul's, including Bill and Terry and Gail and my Stephen minister, Daphne. I was still very, very sad. And then it happened. I created the loudest noise I had ever made by attempting to silence myself. The year was 1997, and it was the week before the long Labor Day weekend. I swallowed a large amount of pills, and I waited. And my Stephen minister showed up at my home, and I waited with her. And unbeknownst to me, she called Terry Thompson, and I was whisked away to St. Luke's Episcopal Hospital for several days. ICU 3, bed 3. I remember it well because I ended up doing clinical training, and that was one of my assignments. And then I spent a long weekend, long Labor Day weekend, at a psychiatric hospital here. A new me was being born that Labor Day weekend. Remember, as Mark Twain said, the two most important days of your life are the day you are born and the day you find out why. Well, it would still take me a number of years to find that why portion. So let's fast forward. You know, I spent some time here. I went to Union Seminary in New York for a semester and a half. 3 years as a chaplain at St. Luke's and Texas Children's. 2 years at Holy Names University in Oakland. A year at the Chaplaincy Institute in Berkeley, which led to this interfaith ordination. The miracle of new love and marriage to a wise man from the East, my dear Malik from Baghdad, which brought me the gift of a global family. And yes, my long last board certification through the APC, the Association of Professional Chaplains. Many people said that would never happen to me. So I am extremely, extremely grateful. And yet, I still stand here today wrestling with that moral obligation to be happy. For a number of reasons. I understand it intellectually. I really do. But it is simply difficult for me to live it in my daily practice. 2 years ago, I moved away from full-time chaplaincy, and it was a difficult decision. I went to work at Seton Cove as an interfaith educator. It's our spirituality center that's affiliated with the Seton Healthcare Network up there. We are three educators and our director, and we teach a wide variety of classes to the Austin community and beyond. Most of them are on mindfulness, spirituality, creativity, and leadership. And with this work and play, I have the opportunity to offer classes to staff across our 10 hospital sites. These luncheons are called Tranquility Place. All staff who attend are given a free lunch. So I always tell them, when you say there's no such thing as a free lunch, you get it every month. I love it. I call it a happy meal. But we go out and give them some kind of mindful teaching to interrupt the busyness of working in healthcare. And unfortunately, the people who absolutely need it the most are too busy to attend. I love those gatherings. In recent months, I have focused on teaching and learning more about happiness. Like I said, during the summer, there were a lot of layouts at our hospital system, so people were scared. Have you noticed how many books and articles have been published on happiness in recent years? It feels like every magazine I pick up has tips on achieving happiness. Rick Hansen has a new book out on the neuroscience of happiness, how some of us are better hardwired for it. Why all these happiness books? I now feel like we are also measuring and quantifying happiness, and if I don't achieve happiness at a certain level, I will have also failed. The good old American way, right? So, I was really delighted when I found this article in Psychology Today by Harriet Lerner, PhD. She's written a number of books on relationships, titles like Marriage Rules, The Dance of Anger. Don't you like those combined together? Marriage Rules, The Dance of Anger. Well, she wrote an article recently called The Key to Happiness in One Easy Step. Well, I'm there. I wanted to know what that was. I mean, that moral obligation for happiness puts a lot of pressure on a person, and if I could achieve it in one easy step, I wanted to know what it was. Right? So here's a portion of her story. Do you want happiness to be available to you at any time, no matter how difficult your life may be? Would you like to always be in the flow of the present moment, living each day to the fullest and exuding such a deep sense of calm, joy, and happiness that everyone wants to be around you? Are you hooked? Well, the key to achieving perfect happiness is a simple one. You need to become a cat. She goes on, consider Felix, now deceased, who is my little Buddhist, my feline role model for mindful living. He demonstrated a healthy fight or flight response when threatened, but he only felt fear when fear was due. He didn't let fear or worry spoil an otherwise perfectly good day. Felix lived in the moment. When he played, he played. When he ate, he ate. When he had sex, he had sex, utterly unencumbered by fear, shame, or guilt. When he licked his fur, he didn't worry about whether he was doing the job well enough, or whether he was taking too long to lick down all his hair, or whether certain of his body parts weren't all that attractive and perhaps shouldn't be displayed for my dinner guests. Nor did he dissipate his energy with anxious thoughts such as, what's wrong with me that I don't make more fruitful and creative use of my time? Don't we do that? Because Felix didn't live a fear-driven life, he was able to operate from his essential Felixness. When he wanted connection, he would jump on my lap without stopping to wonder whether I might find him too needy and dependent. With equal aplomb, he would jump off my lap and saunter out of the room when he felt like it, never worrying that I might take his departure personally and feel really hurt. She continues, of course, Felix didn't have it all. If he missed out on the miseries of being human, he missed out on some uniquely human pleasures, from reading a riveting novel to also falling in love. One might debate whether it is preferable to be a cat or a person, but why get into that? If you are listening to me now, as I am reading this now, you are not a cat and never will be. So along with the good days, you're going to experience the entire range of painful emotions that make us human. This means that you'll wake up at 3 in the morning searching your breast for lumps. You'll worry that your daughter has dropped out of her drug treatment program again, that your partner is getting bored with you, that you'll end up homeless if you leave your job, that your memory is getting more porous with each passing day, and that possibly you're going crazy. You make your own list. Not one of us is immune to this. So what can we do? Well, we all want a quick fix. To let real happiness in, however, we need to understand and accept the full range of human emotions. As the poet Mark Nepo says, we need to assume our full stature. Maybe, just maybe, we have a moral obligation to be authentic to the moment. Hear these words from Osho. Sadness gives depth. Happiness gives height. Sadness gives roots. Happiness gives branches. Happiness is like a tree going into the sky, and sadness is like the roots going into the womb of the earth. But both are needed, and the higher a tree goes, the deeper it goes simultaneously. The bigger the tree, the bigger will be the roots. In fact, it is always in proportion. That is its balance. Sadness and happiness. That is why I have always loved my work as a chaplain. It is the fullness of our living and dying. A few years back, I received one of the most powerful emails I have ever gotten. It was from a cancer patient. An incredibly bright and well-educated man, he had a law degree. A case of his was even argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he was homeless. Life had taken a heavy toll on him through a series of difficult events. He was also a veteran. He used to hang out at the UT Law School Library to catch up with the news, stories of law, and to write emails. He had no phone, so this was our way of keeping him current with appointments and lab tests. When he came in for chemo, he and I would work the New York Times crossword puzzle together. Like I said, he was a really bright guy. I loved hearing his stories. I loved our email exchanges. And I loved him. One day he wrote these words to me. Stephanie, thank you. When I'm at sea about something, I've learned if I find you, it will be all right. That's important. And he signed his name. And then the email stopped. I will never forget this email or the gift of his presence. He taught me so much about living in the present moment and our human need for connection and service toward one another. I want to share a portion of another story, and this is not my story. It's about the recent death of Lou Reed. Anybody read this in Rolling Stone? It's amazing. Laurie Anderson, his wife, she's a performance artist, a meditator, wrote about their life together. And it's a beautiful description of her husband's death and how to live when a spouse has terminal illness. It begins this way. She wrote, Lou and I played music together, became best friends, and then soulmates, traveled, listened to, and criticized each other's work, studied things together, butterfly hunting, meditating, kayaking. We made up ridiculous jokes, stopped smoking 20 times, fought, learned to hold our breath underwater, went to Africa, sang opera in elevators, made friends with unlikely people, followed each other on tour when we could, got a sweet piano-playing dog, shared a house that was separate from our own places, protected and loved each other. We were always seeing a lot of art and music and plays and shows, and I watched as he loved and appreciated other artists and musicians. He was always so generous. Like many couples, we've constructed ways to be, strategies and sometimes compromises that would enable us to be part of a pair. Sometimes we lost a bit more than we were able to give, or gave up way too much, or felt abandoned. Sometimes we got really angry. But even when I was mad, I was never bored. We learned to forgive each other. And somehow, for 21 years, we tangled our minds and hearts together. I guess there are a lot of ways to get married, she wrote. Some people marry someone they hardly know, which can work out too. When you marry your best friend of many years, there should be another name for it. But the thing that surprised me about getting married was the way it altered time, and also the way it added a tenderness that was somehow completely new. To paraphrase Willie Nelson, 90% of the people in the world end up with the wrong person, and that's what makes the jukebox spin. Isn't that great? Love that. Lou's jukebox spun for love and many other things too. Beauty, pain, history, courage, mystery. Lou was sick for the last couple years, first from treatments of interferon, a vile but sometimes effective series of injections that treats hepatitis C and comes with lots of nasty side effects. Then he developed liver cancer, topped off with advancing diabetes. We got good at hospitals. He learned everything about the diseases and treatments. He kept doing Tai Chi every day for 2 hours, plus photography, books, recordings, and so on. Their teacher, Nyingyur Rinpoche, said, "You need to try to master the ability to feel sad without actually being sad." So last spring, at the last minute, Lou received a liver transplant, which seemed to work perfectly. And he almost instantly regained his health and energy. Then, too, that began to fail. And there was no way out. But when the doctor said, "That's it, we have no more options," the only part of that Lou heard was options. He didn't give up until the last half hour of his life, when he suddenly accepted it, all at once and completely. We were at home. I'd gotten him out of the hospital a few days before, and even though he was extremely weak, he insisted on going out into the bright morning light. As meditators, we had prepared for this, how to move the energy up from the belly and into the heart and out through the head. I have never seen an expression as full of wonder as Lou's as he died. His hands were doing the water-flowing 21 form of Tai Chi. His eyes were wide open. I was holding him in my arms, the person I love most in the world, and talking to him as he died. His heart stopped. He wasn't afraid. I had gotten to walk with him to the end of the world. Life, so beautiful, painful, and dazzling, does not get better than this. And death? I believe that the purpose of death is the release of love. At the moment, she writes, I have only the greatest happiness, and I am so proud of the way he lived and died with incredible power and incredible grace. Isn't that beautiful? It's not a denial of death or pain or suffering or what might have been. It is a meditation on happiness in the midst of death and pain and suffering and what might have been. You might be thinking, so where is the happy talk in all of this, with all this sickness and dying stuff? Well, hopefully I'm getting there. I came across these words written recently from Elizabeth Rabia Roberts. She writes, "Winter, after all, is not a failed summer. Winter, after all, is not a failed summer. It is necessary for the renewal of life. There is a lineage of both religious and secular literature reminding us that times of total darkness are a natural part of the human condition. To descend, submit, and die. The openness to being acted upon is the essence of the human experience when we come face to face with the transpersonal. It is a defining part of the spiritual life. A singular aspect of every major life change is the need to move from our thinking capacities to our deeper knowings. For millennia, our ancestors acknowledged and honored these transformational experiences through ceremonies and myths about a descent into the underworld, where our old identity is stripped away. There, we must stumble blindly, waiting for a new dark light that guides us to our rebirth and to greater awareness and wisdom. Unfortunately," she continues, "our present Western culture prefers to hide death and medicate unhappiness, making these natural rites of passage all the more difficult. Our commercial media teach our young that happiness is a reliable measure of success in life, and grief, sadness, and uncertainty and loss are all signs of a failure to grasp the American dream. In our culture, growth and fulfillment are defined by accumulating, not by letting go." So, sadness is not failed happiness. It, too, is necessary for the renewal of life. I appreciate and love so much all that I continue to learn in my dying and coming to life again. With the help and the love of Bill and others here at St. Paul's, I first began learning that process. And in my work as a chaplain, I've had the incredible privilege of being present to others in this process of discovery. In my marriage to Malik, a Muslim civil engineer from Baghdad, who has witnessed and experienced more tragedy than I can truly comprehend, I continue to appreciate, learn and relearn this dying and coming to life again. He and his family, who are scattered in many parts of this world, now continue to teach me about resilience and, yes, happiness, even in the midst of great sadness or sitting in the middle of a war zone. How am I doing? Maybe we need to show this video in a minute. I want you to remember that it takes both. There is no distinction between happiness and sadness. We need the fullness of both. Perhaps that little sliver of faith, combined with the revolution of the heart, with an openness to seeing, hearing, feeling, knowing, whatever befalls us in authentic love, assuming our full stature in those moments of living and dying, in sadness and joy, in anger and fear, discovering why we are here, perhaps that leads to our moral obligation to be happy. And when we realize our full truth, maybe it is that we have a moral obligation to love. Recently on Facebook, I have this dear friend. His name is Omid Safi. I have never met him personally, but we friended one another. And he shared this story with his two young daughters. Roya, 13 years old. "Baba, if you do this and that, will you make more money?" He responds, "Honey, you know what we always say. It's not so important that you have more money. It's much more important to be happy in life." "Okay, Baba." Meanwhile, his six-year-old daughter, Layla, begins, "Actually, it's not more important to be happy. It's more important to love people. You can't always be happy, but you can always love people." So now I have a video, I hope. Pay attention to really when this man is dancing in North Korea. So, there's a YouTube video talking about these journeys that he makes. This is, I think, the third one that he's done. And that woman that danced with him in North Korea, he was really lucky to even get that because everywhere he went, it was a real controlled setting. And he was afraid that nobody was going to dance with him. And he was just kind of standing there doing his happy mat dance. And suddenly she broke out of the crowd, out of that controlled crowd. So she was actually risking her life for a moment of happiness with him. So I thank you so much. I've had a great time. And I hope you've had a happy time. Thank you for inviting me back. All of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I need a hug.
Okay. We got these on.
I know it. You see it. So I told you last week, you don't want to miss today. Right? Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
No matter where you go this week, no matter what happens, remember this, you carry precious cargo, so watch your step. See you next week.